Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Today is a bit of a mental day for me because I'm going to the US tomorrow, today when you're listening to this, but this is Thursday recording this. And I thought, you know what? It'll be grand. Do a podcast. What's going to happen? We're certainly not going to sign any players. The team are going to be traveling to the US. There's going to be very little happening. You know what we'll do? We'll have a good conversation about the one tangible thing that has occurred this week, which is the appointment of Edu as our technical director. That's a thing that happened. It's real. It exists. So let's talk about Edu. Edu as a player when he was with us. Edu as a football administrator with Corinthians and the Brazil national side. Edu's new job and the kind of influence he might have over the club and our playing style, our philosophy, our transfer business, all of that. Let's have a lovely, nice conversation about that. I can get my bags packed. No hassle. Everything will be hunky-dory. And then we get the news that Lauren Koscielny has refused to go on the tour of America. The club captain has refused to travel with the team, and all the shit has hit the fan, as you would expect, because, well, you know, that's a bad thing to have happened. It's bad from Koscielny to behave in that way. There's absolutely no condoning that kind of behavior. He has a responsibility as the club captain to fulfill the duties that are expected of him as a player, as one of our most senior players, and as the captain of the club itself. There's absolutely no way you can excuse it or condone it in any way. However, you do have to think about why it's happened. Lauren Koscielny's not somebody who we know as an agitator. This is a guy who has put his body on the line for us. Last season, after coming back from the injury when we really, really needed him week in, week out, when he probably could have done without playing as regularly as he did, he was still suffering from the effects of, A, the tendonitis that's chronic with him anyway, and that traumatic Achilles tendon snap. He didn't shirk his responsibilities. He played at times when he shouldn't have played. And down the years, you know, this is a guy who's got kicked in the head. He's been smashed around all over the place. For 9 years, he's given the club more or less impeccable service in terms of his professionalism. Of course, like any player, there have been ups and downs and there have been some mistakes and what have you. But this is not who Lauren Koscielny is. Certainly not the Lauren Koscielny that we've known over the last 9 years. So what has driven him, fully aware that he is the club captain, to have made the decision not to go on the tour, knowing how it would reflect on him, knowing how it would be reported in the papers? What has gone on? I think we really have to think about it from that point of view. Is it just a case that he wants more money in France? I don't think it is. He's 33 years of age. He's going to be 34 in September. Maybe he wants the security of a 2-year contract. Maybe he just really wants to go back to France. But I think there are ways and means of making that happen without resorting to this kind of drastic behavior. And the response from Arsenal, okay, some will say, hang him out to dry. The way he's behaved is unacceptable. Let's just hang him out, name and shame him. That's not really the way that we do things. It's not the way we've done things in the past. I was put in mind immediately of the statement that Atletico Madrid put out about Antoine Griezmann during the week about his shenanigans with Barcelona. It feels a bit Spanish. It feels a bit Barcelona to me. Is this Raúl Señeji making the decision? But what's gone on behind the scenes to have caused this kind of a breakdown in the relationship and for Arsenal to behave in a way which isn't really the way Arsenal tend to behave with situations like this? Maybe we've been a bit soft in the past, but maybe also there's a good reason to keep things in-house as much as possible. Could Koscielny not have been reported injured or ill? We've done that in the past with plenty of players, where we have dealt with situations behind the scenes without causing an absolute furore on the eve of our preseason tour or on the eve of a game or whatever it might be. So I think there's a lot going on, a lot that we don't know. There's a lot to unpack. There's probably plenty more to come out in the wash. And whichever side of this you find yourself on, or whether you're sort of just looking at it in wide-eyed bemusement as I am right now, it's not good. It's not healthy. It doesn't speak to cohesiveness and cohesion and harmony behind the scenes. It's bad for Koscielny. It's bad for Arsenal. It's bad for Señeji. It's bad for Unai Emery. And I'm not pinning blame on the manager or the head coach for this. I'm just saying that as a situation for Arsenal Football Club to find itself in so publicly at this point of the summer when so little else has gone on, it just really doesn't reflect well on what's happening. Obviously, it could all look a lot rosier in a couple of weeks' time, but I think I've been saying that for a few weeks now, where you go, well, you know, it could be better in a few weeks' time. It could be. And then a few weeks pass, and you're going, well, maybe in another few weeks. But all we can do is keep fingers crossed that it is, and that this is kind of the low point of what has been a pretty disappointing summer so far. Anyway, we are going to talk Edu in a little while, but obviously the big story of the day was Lauren Koscielny, his refusal to go on the US tour. The ramifications of that are serious for the player and for the club, and with me to discuss all of that and more, including transfers, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show, as always, David Ornstein. Hi, David.
Hey, Andrew. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. People have been waiting for things to happen this summer. I don't know that this was something anybody really expected. How much of a bolt from the blue has this been, and what has happened?
Yeah, I don't think the situation per se has been a bolt from the blue, because this had been brewing behind the scenes. But most of us only found out about it when the news broke via Arsenal's statement this morning. And in terms of his refusal to travel with the squad to the USA, that has come as a bolt out of the blue, because that news was only relayed to Arsenal on Wednesday morning by Koscielny. He informed Unai Emery in a face-to-face meeting that he wouldn't be travelling. Emery was understandably, predictably furious with that. And then the news was obviously relayed to Arsenal's head of football, Raúl Señeji, and he sent a message to Lauren Koscielny expressing the club's anger and disbelief and disappointment, and making Koscielny aware that if he didn't travel to the USA, he would be in breach of contract and face disciplinary measures. Later on, Koscielny replied, emphasising his stance, which we can talk about in greater depth, and the position and his feelings. And then he arrived at London Colney on Thursday morning and confirmed that he wouldn't be travelling. And that's pretty much when Arsenal released their statement, I think, to get on the front foot on that one. So yeah. Arsenal departed at 12:30 without Koscielny on the flight. He now will be required to train with the remaining players at London Colney, mainly young players. If he doesn't do that, he'll also be in breach of contract. And the club are going through the disciplinary proceedings already to establish what punishment or punishments Koscielny will receive.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a... a strange situation in that I think we all understood that Lauren Koscielny might want to leave. There was certainly talk of that last year. His agent was quite clear that, you know, had he not sustained that Achilles injury in the Europa League semi-final against Atletico Madrid, he would have coincided his departure with that of Arsene Wenger, or at least attempted to do that. But Koscielny, in the 9 or 10 years that he's been with Arsenal, has been a very professional player, a very professional guy. How has it got to a point where the action has become quite as drastic as this, where, you know, he can't be unaware of his commitments and his responsibilities as club captain, yet he is prepared to refuse to go on tour in order to facilitate a departure from the club? But, you know, it feels almost, even if it has been brewing in the background, it's sort of gone from 1 to 100 in a very short period of time.
To explain the situation properly, we need to understand exactly what's happened behind the scenes. And although I think him not going on the tour has come to a head very quickly, the wider situation has been brewing for quite some time. And as I understand it, it dates back to his return from the serious Achilles injury in December 2018. Since then, he's become increasingly discontent and unhappy, primarily over issues such as the management of his playing schedule, the Sunday-Thursday sort of relentless slog, and also separately the direction in which he feels the team and the club are moving, and how they're currently operating. He's not the first to feel this way, and it certainly doesn't excuse his behaviour, but I'm just explaining his perspective. It also doesn't relate to how grateful he is for how Arsenal stood by him during his injury, which I've seen a lot of people complaining about. These are sort of separate issues. However, as Arsenal were challenging to get back into the Champions League, the two parties sat down for negotiations over a new contract that would see him extend, I think, I don't know this for a fact, but I think it would see him extend by a year on top of the remaining 12 months on his contract. I don't think they'd finalised how long they were looking at. And I think he saw a brighter future for him and the club if Champions League football was attained. However, Arsenal missed out, obviously, in Baku with the defeat by Chelsea. And that has changed everything, not just for Koscielny, but for many other players. And, of course, it's changed things enormously for Arsenal's recruitment hopes, their plans and their possibilities. So Koscielny went away and decided pretty much that it was time to call it a day at Arsenal after 9 largely sort of memorable years. With some ups and downs, but time to return to France. He didn't want to be part of the club any longer. And so when he returned from his break, he informed Arsenal of this, and he thought it could be resolved amicably given his long service and his professionalism up until this point. But Arsenal rejected that idea, and they were very keen on him being part of their plans for next season, a key part of their plans. Unai Emery was happy with his level of performance last season, and they also expected him, quite understandably, to see out the final year of his contract. However, he is of the opinion that somewhere along the line there's been an agreement that would allow him to leave for free this summer. Now, Arsenal dispute that. They sort of categorically deny that that was the case. And sort of separately to that, or failing that, he thinks that there is an offer on the table or incoming. I don't know exactly what status it's at, that will be acceptable for Arsenal. However, complicating all of that is that I've spoken to some people who are aware of these proposals, and they don't think Arsenal will deem that acceptable. And others entirely say there's no offer on the table, so there's nothing even for Arsenal to think about at this point. So it's a complete and utter mess. And then it all came to a head from Wednesday morning onwards.
Yeah, I mean, I think complete and utter mess sums it up, doesn't it? Because we're in a situation where Arsenal this summer have many issues to sort out. Defence is really one of the biggest ones. And We're in a situation where probably the best central defender at the club is a 33-year-old who's about to turn 34, who is, you know, not crippled, but who is clearly affected by an ongoing tendonitis problem, a traumatic injury. And you can understand Arsenal's point of view, why they would want to keep him, because it makes it more difficult to perhaps move on some of the other players in defence that they might want to shift. You know, this is Raul Senyehi's first summer in full charge as the head of football. You know, however people want to look at this and however they want to talk about Koscielny and the way he's behaved, and as you say, and I think I'm on board, you can't condone the way that the club captain has behaved. But you do have to question why it is it has come to this and why this thing has been played out so publicly. Very often the Arsenal way is to sort of not necessarily brush it under the carpet, but to throw a cloak over it a little bit and say Koscielny can't go on the tour because, you know, he's got a back injury or he's, you know, picked up a hamstring problem, and it gets dealt with that way. You know, Arsenal this time have gone public straight away with this and caused this sort of furore. So it doesn't really reflect well on anybody, particularly with just 4 weeks left of the transfer window.
Yeah, I've spoken to some people today who feel it was very unlike Arsenal and out of keeping with the club's traditions and ways of operating to have released this. But you can't have your cake and eat it. We're always asking, why aren't they coming out and confirming what we all knew about Sven Mislintat, Darren Burgess, about the physios who were sacked last summer, you know, the Ozil contract, etc., etc. The list goes on. And then when they have come on the front foot and tried to take control of the situation and deny anyone else the chance to break news from across the media and leave them in a potentially even more embarrassing situation. And of course, you'll see he's not in the squad because they publish the list and then everyone would be asking what's going on. They would probably, maybe historically, have said something like he's injured, he'll be staying behind to train. Someone would have got the story and then we would have all had a go at Arsenal for not coming out with the information. So yeah. I don't think you can win in that situation. And I don't think there's any proven way to deal with those sorts of scenarios. I've seen as many people saying today that they've dealt with it well as people that have saying they've dealt with it badly. And if we forget the PR as well, they need to get on with an incredibly important summer. I mean, you mentioned the defensive side of things now. This is a major headache for them, and it's one that is not of their own making, they will feel. Despite what Koscielny and his people feel about the climate and the environment and the reasons that have led him to take this decision, Arsenal have close to completing a deal for Saliba. It's not final yet because they've got to work through a few finalise the details on that one. But they're close to completing that deal. However, he'll go back to St Etienne for the entirety of next season, and that's not going to change. He's 18 years old, and that's in the plan. So you can write him off for a year. Rob Holding's still recovering from his knee injury. I'm told that Konstantinos Mavropanos is not seen as a credible option at the moment, that there are concerns over his development and his readiness physically. I don't know if it's mentally as well, but I was just told his development and his readiness to compete for a position now are of concern. And then there's the Mustafi situation, which you and I have spoken about before.
Yeah.
They've tried to sell him in the past. They would like to sell him against this summer. In the aftermath and the fallout from the Europa League final, even Emery, who had backed him in his first season at the club, despite the series of high-profile errors, he decided enough was enough. Just to be clear, that wasn't... I know that he didn't play in the final. People have pointed out that he didn't play. It was at the end of the season. His reflections was that Mustafi can go. But Mustafi is under contract until 2021 and has no desire to leave. So that one is not going to work. He's going to be staying. They were already looking to recruit in that area to bolster the ranks when it included Koscielny. So this is a major headache. They've still got to sort the winger that they're after, Zaha, which, I, as I've reported, I think they stand very little chance of landing him. £40 million offer was thrown out by Crystal Palace immediately. £40 million plus, you know, reports that they'll throw in the likes of Carl Jenkinson, Mohamed Elneny, who Crystal Palace turned down last summer, and also one other player.
It was Callum Chambers.
Chambers. Crystal Palace are not interested in any of these players. They're scoffing at any kind of suggestion that they'd be interested in taking players like that. Something enormous has got to change for the Zaha situation to materialise. You'd have to think a major sale, or out of the blue, the Kroenke family investing some of their own money, which is very difficult to do under financial fair play rules. They can invest some. Don't get me wrong, but and I'm not the sort of financial expert on this, but yeah. I don't know if they can invest the sort of money that people would like to see them invest under financial fair play rules. Then there's the midfielder that they have been seeking for a long time, a box-to-box midfielder, a replacement for Aaron Ramsey. We've seen very little sort of concrete speculation around that position. Pursuing Kieran Tierney at left-back, that one's gone quiet since their initial offer was rejected, and you know, there's an expectation that they'll come back in for him, but I don't think it's moving anywhere at the moment. So if I take this all the way back to the statement and whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, I don't think they really care whether it was a good thing or a bad thing compared to the bigger issues that they've got on their plate involving their captain and their overall recruitment, with the transfer deadline of the 8th of August starting to creep into sight.
Just going back to the central defensive issue, when you talk about Mavropanos not being considered a credible option at this moment in time, that might suggest that he could go on loan somewhere for a year. Obviously, Callum Chambers is somebody who can play, but, you know, if it's a case that Koscielny goes, they don't want Mustafi. Chambers is somebody they're willing to offer to Crystal Palace. Holding is not going to be fit for the start of the season because he's recovering from his cruciate ligament injury, which he picked up maybe a month before Hector Bellerin. So, you know, he's a little bit further down the road, but not quite there to start games. So that leaves Arsenal with basically one central defender that they want, and that's Socrates, who is 30, 31 years of age. Do you have any insight into why it is then that Christian Bielik, who played very well for Charlton last season, I know it was in League One, but he helped them in midfield gain promotion to the Championship. He went away to the European Under-21 Championships, was one of the standout players there. He wants first-team football at Arsenal. Is there the possibility that, despite reports this week that Unai Emery has no role for him at the club, that the Koscielny situation might well force that, or at least open the door for someone like Bielik to be given an opportunity?
That's a great question, and it's one, sadly, I don't have an answer to, because every time I pose the Bielik question to people I speak to, I don't get a response, and I don't know whether that's because he's not in their mind as a credible option, or he is and they just don't want to let on. But if that was the case, you would start to see him sort of figuring more prominently in conversation. Usually when clubs have high hopes for somebody, they're quite happy to talk about them. The word coming from Polish journalists is that he's given up and that he wants to move on now. He would have loved to have made it at Arsenal, but that he's been given no reason for encouragement. And in response to your question, could they be forced into it now? Well, I don't really think so, because if the past is anything to go by, they'll just turn back to Mustafi, partner him with Socrates, hope that Koscielny sorts himself out and plays. I think there's a feeling among some that, you know, by Christmas time, the central defensive partnership would be Rob Holding, Socrates, Callum Chambers in the mix. Chambers is determined to win a place at Arsenal. I know that much, but clearly from what we've seen, I don't know, just a year ago during the World Cup, I reported that Arsenal had big hopes for him and he was set to sign a new contract. He signed that new contract. He then went out to Fulham, and some people at the club think it's not going to happen for Callum Chambers, given that at Fulham, the position that he impressed in was not the position that Arsenal would want him to impress in.
Yeah,
he impressed in a holding midfield role. So that's a really tricky situation. There are people within the game that have always had their doubts about Chambers managing to establish himself as a top quality centre-half. So it's whether the existing resources can patch up the situation. Whether they enter the market and bring someone in.
Well, you mentioned
limited budget.
You mentioned Koscielny there, like Socrates, Mustafi, and Koscielny. I mean, do you see a situation where Koscielny can stay at the club? Because it feels very much, after the way this has all gone down, that his position is basically untenable, which of course might well be exactly what he wants.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, Arsene Wenger always said, like, you can't keep an unhappy player, a player who doesn't want to be there. You don't get the level of performance from them that you need. And at 33, 34 anyway, you know, this is not like losing a 25, 26-year-old player coming into his prime. This is losing a player who is certainly in the September of his career, if we're going to put that diplomatically. But, you know, is there a possibility that the fences could be mended?
Well, it's looking very difficult at this stage. And the irony of Arsenal being honest and transparent and putting that statement out rather than hiding behind, say, an injury that they may have got away with and tried to sort the situation out. The irony of fronting up means, you're right, it looks untenable now. If he can't be relegated to the reserve, you know, the no. under-23s for a season because they're paying him a decent salary. He's an international footballer. In that sense, it would be much better for the club if he leaves rather than not playing. And the consensus I've sort of garnered today is that the statement going out very clearly expresses Arsenal's dissatisfaction. But it also ends any hopes of the problem being mended. And the likelihood is that whether Koscielny has now sort of burned his relationship with Arsenal as a club and their supporters, the likelihood is that he'll get his way of moving back to France and Arsenal reluctantly sanctioning his departure. But, you know, we're told there's no offer on the table. So are they ultimately going to let him have what he wanted originally, which was to be released for nothing? Or are the various parties just going to bring some sort of offer to the table so that Arsenal receive an element of compensation for him? Are they going to try and integrate their existing resources with some, you know, some of the younger options like Medley, or dip into the market and bring in a stopgap for one season with Saliba coming in a year's time if that deal gets finally pushed over the line? You know what, I don't have many answers, and many people say, oh, you know, why not? And the only answer I can give is that I don't think the club has many answers at the moment. And they're sort of moving in a very rapid and fluid situation that seems to be changing by the day, because, you know, not much more than 24 hours ago, they expected Koscielny to be going on tour. Now he's not, and the future of their captain seems to be engraved out.
Right. Just one final question, because I really do appreciate the time you've given me this evening. It's late in the evening. You've been working at Wimbledon all day. You know, if I don't ask, though, people will go crazy. So in terms of transfers, is there anything imminent from an Arsenal point of view, inward or outward?
Yeah, no. So Saliba, they need to get that over the line. There are still some small details that need to be finalised. It's more the wording of parts of the contract. And these are usually things that don't bring a deal down. So the agreement seems to be pretty much there with both the clubs and the player. So I think now that's really just in the hands of the lawyers. They just need to push that one over the line. Arsenal showed the most concrete and relentless interest. There was late interest from Tottenham, but some politics got in the way of that at their end. So they seem to have been pushed out of the running. And also Wolves were very strong on the case. But Arsenal appear to have got Saliba, and I hear amazing things about him. So it's clearly a bit unfortunate that they'll have to wait a year, but I think all parties deem that to be the right decision. But aside from that, nothing is imminent, I'm afraid. I'd be staggered if the Zaha transfer comes to fruition. So in that position, they'll be having to look for an alternative option if they still want to go ahead with it. Of course, there's Reece Nelson coming back in, but, you know, there are some... He's still early in his career. If you watched him in Germany, he had some inconsistent moments. He's still got a lot to prove, primarily to Unai Emery, who previously in the past had some concerns about him. So they clearly want to bring in someone who can provide width. I've seen Malcolm linked. I don't know about the current links with Malcolm, but certainly... that was a transfer that they had pursued in the past, as we know, and that was a Sanlehi-led transfer. So it wouldn't be a great shock if they went back down that route, especially given his links, Sanlehi's links to Barcelona, and it not being a great first season for Malcolm. But I don't think that's going to be particularly cheap, and that doesn't sit well with Arsenal's budget. the Ryan Fraser situation, I think, I don't know a great deal about it, but it was clearly there to be done at the right price, and Arsenal don't seem to be able to or want to go in at that price. So that wing situation, a lot of people ask me about Hakim Ziyech. Arsenal have analysed him, and he's not a player that they will be pursuing, as far as I know. I think he would welcome the move. I think... Ajax would probably sell for around £30 million, but that's not on Arsenal's agenda. The left-back, we know they're primarily focused on Kieran Tierney. I don't know any alternative targets. There have been, you know, there are previously names like Moreno mentioned, but he's obviously signed for Villarreal. And, you know, Tierney, again, it's a deal that's there to be done, but Arsenal have to get to the asking price or strike a deal. Again, with this sort of budget, we're told is around £45 million. Everybody or lots of people say that's nonsense. There's a much bigger budget, but we've got no reason to suspect there is a bigger budget. We know that they, like all deals in the industry, will operate in installments. And so, you know, they can potentially do some decent business with that this summer. You know, say a 10 million installment here, 5 million there, 15 million there. So there are deals to be done. In terms of the central midfielder, again, lots of names linked, and Lamina most recently, that seems to be one being driven more by the player in his camp. I don't know about it, so I'm not doubting any of those reports, but I can't add to them. But it's a long way of answering your question that is anything imminent other than potentially Saliba? No.
Okay, well, look, Arsenal are away on tour in the USA, and we'll see. Maybe we'll get some surprises over the next week or so. But David, as always, pleasure to talk to you, and thank you very much indeed again for your time.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much to David Ornstein. He was working all day at Wimbledon for the BBC, but still took some time out to talk to us here on the Arsecast, so we really do appreciate it. The sound quality, because of where he was a little bit hit and miss for a little while at the start, but there you go. That happens. It's about the information and the quality of the information rather than the clarity of the sound. You can follow David on Twitter at @BBCSport_David.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog.
This week, Arsenal appointed former Gunner, former Invincible and former midfielder Edu as our new and very first technical director. He is a former Brazilian international. He's been working with the Brazilian national team, and we're going to get some background on him. And who better to chat to about anything Brazilian than Tim Stillman. Hi, Tim.
Hello there.
A few people have asked me on Twitter and maybe on the Discord, the Arsblog Discord server, to talk a little bit about Edu as a player, because they don't really remember him. He played his last game for us in 2005, which is 14 years ago. So while everybody will have been aware that he was part of the Invincibles, not too many, or not everyone, rather, would have seen him play or understood what kind of a player he was. Were you a fan when he was with us? Because I loved him. I just sort of have a thing for left-footed midfielders because they fill this Liam Brady gap in my life.
it makes you feel old, doesn't it, when you think he left 14 years ago. Like, where has that time gone?
I know.
I did like him. Yes, I did like him a lot. He never really established himself in the first 11 at Arsenal, and he was kind of unfortunate to come. Maybe unfortunate's overstating it. He still played a really, really big, significant role. Won two league titles, I think three FA Cups. You know, that's not a bad haul in 4 years. And he had a good part in all of that. But he never quite nailed down a starting spot because, you know, this was the era of 4-4-2, and we had Patrick Vieira, and Vieira and Edu, that was, like, offensively, that was a really, really good combination. Mm. But where we had Gilberto Silva, who was probably a little bit more important just in kind of keeping the back door shut. In this day and age, Edu would, you know, well, of course he'd walk into our midfield at the moment, but probably in any era after the one in which he played, when you move to more three-man midfields, he'd have made far more appearances and far more starts. It's just that we had Vieira, and then Edu was this kind of left-footed playmaker type. I'd say, not quite like Granit Xhaka, quite a bit more mobile than Granit Xhaka, although that's a fairly low bar. he had a bit of tenacity about him. Like, he didn't mind a tackle. But I think what most people would remember him for is that wonderful left foot, kind of his ability just to open up the pitch a little bit, because we had two right-footed wingers in Freddie Ljungberg and Robert Pires. Patrick Vieira was right-footed. I think our entire, well, no, other than Ashley Cole, all of our centre-backs and our right-back were right-footed. So he just gave us, like, he just opened the pitch up a little bit with that left foot, and he was a wonderful passer and had a really good shot on him. So he wasn't quite in the deep-lying playmaker role. He was very much a number eight, but you'd say, like, he had a bit of everything, really. He was cultured, as all left-footed players tend to be.
Of course.
Poetic left foot and all of that. But he could put a tackle in, and I don't think that's something he had when he arrived at Arsenal, but it's something he developed. And and actually, that's what he started to get into the Brazilian national side in about 2004. They went to Copa America, and Copa America, usually it's not really taken that seriously. And Brazil left a lot of their kind of big ticket names at home for the 2004 Copa America, and they brought him with them, and he kind of got into the team on the basis of the fact that he had quite a nicely rounded game, and he could put his foot in and tackle. And unfortunately, I think that's why he left the club in the end, because he was getting kind of more chances for Brazil than he was for Arsenal, and I think he really wanted to keep taking that on.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think, you know, he left because he wanted to run down his contract. My understanding of it was that, you know, things ended a little bit unfortunately, in that he was never offered a new contract to sign, so in the final year. But you used the word unfortunate about Edu. And I think that's, we can go back to how he joined the club and yeah. talk about what a saga that was, because people who don't, aren't aware or don't remember, you know, he joined, he came to London, and he was sent straight back to Brazil when he got to the airport because he used his Portuguese passport, in which, I don't know how to say this, but I guess there were issues or discrepancies.
Yes.
Perhaps the validity of that document was questionable, something which came back to haunt us a bit one summer when all of a sudden Silvinho found himself yes. moved to Spain, and everyone went, what? Why? And then there was, yeah. there was just nothing doing with that. And he had, you know, some unfortunate events in his life as well. I think his sister was killed in a car crash. When he did arrive, I think his debut lasted about 15 minutes. And he absolutely twanged a hamstring. It wasn't just like, I've done my hamstring a little bit here. It was a proper twanger. And he scored an own goal, didn't he? One of his first contributions was to score an own goal, perhaps against Middlesbrough. You know, so the first few months of his Arsenal career were unfortunate, is a good way of putting it.
Yeah, exactly. And he'd have been quite entitled, I think, in the summer of we signed him in the summer of 2000. If in the summer of 2001 he'd have jacked it in and gone home, I don't think anyone would have blamed him, because he tried to arrive in August, and the whole work permit thing, when he was sent back to Brazil, that didn't get sorted until January. So we didn't see him till January, which is probably why he twanged his hamstring on his debut, because he hadn't played and he'd been in Brazil, in like November and December, which is their summer. And then all of a sudden he's playing at Filbert Street in the middle of January. So, of course he had that tragedy with his sister, which I don't think was very well known at the time either. I think that Middlesbrough game was his first start, where him and Silvinho both scored own goals in that game. So, and you know, he came into a team that was doing pretty well as well, and perhaps, you know, I don't say didn't need him, but wasn't absolutely crying for him. And I think in the summer of 2001, if he'd have decided that this just hadn't worked and to jack it all in and to go home and reset, I don't think anyone really would have blamed him. I think I'm right in saying that Arsenal signed Giovanni Van Bronckhorst that summer as well. Very similar type of midfielder, very similar job, kind of left-footed central midfielder, and we spent $8.5 million on him. So, I mean, really, in the back of Arsene Wenger's mind, he must have half given up on Edu to make a signing like that at that expense. So for him in that 2001-2 season to kind of really claw his way back into contention, and by the end of the season, he was in the starting 11. And I think that really tells you something about Edu, that he, you know, he fought against all of these odds when I don't think anyone would have blamed him if he hadn't, to be quite frank.
Yeah, and look, he did, you know, become a very well-liked and very popular player. There was a great moment, wasn't there? I think it was his first goal for Arsenal, and he sort of, it was almost like, oh God, everything that I went through, now something good has happened. There's this great picture, isn't there, of him, he's sort of
on his knees
with his hands in front of him praying, and Gilberto's right there with him, and you'd have to have a heart of stone not to have felt for the guy after everything that he went through. But he did become a really important part of that team. You know, if we, you know, people talk about the Invincibles and you think Vieira and Bergkamp and Henry and Sol Campbell and Pires, etc., but you know, the supporting cast is what really enabled those guys to be as good as they were. Of course, they were brilliant players, but you know, to have the platform to go and do what they did, you need your Ray Parlors, you need your Edus in the team, who are solid, consistent players who will just produce week in, week out.
Yeah, absolutely. And Edu, you know, he had some really big contributions. I think most people would probably remember him most for the Celta Vigo game in the Champions League, where he scored two brilliant goals. But he scored the winner at Stamford Bridge in the Invincible season as well. And, you know, what a huge goal that was in the season. And I seem to remember during that period, actually, that he'd made his case so solidly. I think he won the Premier League Player of the Month for that month. And he made his case so solidly that Arsenal had about a 6-game spell where we played Gilberto on the right wing so that we could accommodate Edu into the middle.
And
obviously
that.
Gilberto wasn't really like a right winger as such. He kind of started on the right and you know, plugged in and stuff like that. But like Arsene changed that midfield just briefly, just to try and get Edu in there. That's how well he was playing.
Yeah, I remember that actually. It didn't really suit Gilberto, it's fair to say. But look, you know, he left, he went to Valencia, he played some for Valencia, didn't have a great time there, I think, because of injury. Went back to Brazil and played for Corinthians, which was the club that we bought him from, and then when he retired, moved into football administration, moved into the executive world of football, and he did have a spell with Corinthians as their director of football.
Yeah, he did, and you know, he had a pretty good spell there as well. I mean, so Corinthians were very, very successful during this spell. So while he was director of football, they won, you know, the Brasileirão, they won the Copa Libertadores, they won the Club World Cup, they beat Chelsea in the final for that. And they brought in a lot of good players, and that was a big part of his role. But there are kind of two characters that you know, tell you that it wasn't just all Edu on his own. I mean, first of all, Corinthians had a fair bit of money, but they also established a relationship with the agent. Oh God, why has my mind gone blank and I can't remember his name?
Which one now?
Kia, that's it.
Oh, Kia Jorbachian.
Yes, yes, yeah. So they had this relationship with Kia Jorabchian. You might remember they brought in Javier Mascherano and Carlos Tevez as well. That was through Kia.
Yeah.
And they kind of, Corinthians forged a relationship with Kia Jorabchian, and Kia still has a stable of South American, particularly Brazilian players. You might notice that a lot of them go to a certain London club. If I say the names Ramirez, Oscar, David Luiz. But the one that's really interesting, and probably the one big blot on Edu's copybook while he was at Corinthians, and I'm not sure how much this was really his choice, was the signing of Alessandro Pato. So Pato had been AC Milan, he'd been injured, and then frankly he stopped bothering being a footballer. But he was one of Kia's stable of players. You might remember that Pato went to Chelsea really weirdly a couple of years ago on loan as well, even though they clearly didn't want him. I'm not sure how much Corinthians wanted him, but they got him, and they got him at great expense on a massive salary, and it was an absolute disaster. It was like, I mean, it was like the Mesut Ozil contract for us. Basically, he was a massive, massive disaster for their wage bill, and they spent ages trying to get rid of him. He went on loan to Sao Paulo, one of their rivals, and they ended up paying half of his wages, and it was a massive millstone on Corinthians. And it stopped them spending money, and they only just got rid of him about 2 years ago, shortly after that Chelsea loan spell. That Chelsea loan spell was about shop windowing him so that someone would buy him. He went to
Villarreal, but I mean, Villarreal are not a club with the kind of money that would. But I guess, you know, after that, he went to China, didn't he? So,
yes.
So there you go. Well, you know, this is a guy perhaps that when we talk about these recruitment policies, whether they're data driven or contacts driven, maybe there's a lesson there for someone like Edu coming in as technical director, that, you know, agents, if they're selling you something, it may not be in your best interest. It's certainly in their best interest and the best interest of their player.
Yeah.
I'll be very curious to see how this dynamic works out with Raul Sanjehi, who is, of course, you know, a schmoozer, that kind of a guy. He is more, an agent-led recruiter, or as far as we know, he has done fuck all this summer. So, you know, we're still shooting around the dark a
bit. It will be very interesting. And I should say that the Kia link-up for Corinthians was more good than bad. It was just that Pato one was really, really bad. So it'd be interesting to see if that's rekindled, because Kia still has a massive stable of South American players. And it'll be interesting to see if that's what Raul sees in Edu, a link to another super agent. It might be, it might not be, but I think that's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, the links to Brazilian players You know, if we start to see more and more of those happening, then, you know, you wouldn't be at all surprised, obviously, because of the kind of connections that, and knowledge, of course, that Edu would have of that local market.
Yeah, this is one of the ironic things, talking about Edu's passport. One of his jobs, so his big tie-up is Chite, the Brazilian coach. So when they were together at Corinthians, when Chite was appointed as the coach of Brazil, he was the only candidate because he's the only half-decent Brazilian coach. So he had a lot of leverage when they came cap in hand to him. Mm. And one of Chite's conditions was, I must have Edu with me. He must be with me in this role. So they got rid of the other guy and they got Edu in. So those two, like, they've been a package for quite a long time. And so this is a big challenge for Edu now, because he's cut that tie, and I imagine that was part of the attraction, him trying to make it on his own.
Yeah.
But one of his big roles for Brazil was lots and lots and lots of Brazilians have dual nationality, and one of the things that started to happen was a lot of these guys started to declare for other countries. And this isn't something Brazil had to worry about before, because they've had, I'm not talking about Brazilian people here, I'm talking about Brazilian FA, they've had this arrogance that we've won 5 World Cups, we don't chase players, they come to us. When we call players up, they die to play for us.
Why wouldn't you play for Brazil, sort of thing?
Exactly. Now, that stopped happening because A, Brazil aren't as big a superpower as they once were, and B, as we can see with Martinelli, Brazilian players are leaving the country younger and younger, so they're losing that connection to their country very, very early. Mm. And there are some big cases that really hurt Brazil. The first one is Thiago Alcantara, who played at Bayern Munich. His dad won the World Cup with Brazil, and he still didn't want to play for them. He declared for Spain. That was a player they really wanted, a player they really needed in the midfield. Even Jorginho, who plays for Chelsea, this is exactly the type of player Brazil had missed for a long, long time. And he declared for Italy because he'd been in Italy for so long, hadn't been back to Brazil, and he didn't really feel that connection anymore. But the one that really hurt them was Diego Costa.
Yeah.
Because he had a straight choice between Brazil and Spain, and he chose Spain, even though he feels Brazilian. When his career ends, he'll go back to Brazil. That's where he is every preseason. So he chose Spain because he thought they were better. So Brazil kind of made this decision. We got to stop this from happening. We've got to get to these guys when they're younger and make them feel involved and convince them there's a pathway to the Brazilian national team. So this was a big part of Edu's role, and this is where I think there'll be an interesting transferable skill to the role he'll be asked to do at Arsenal, because what he was asked to do at Brazil was identify these guys who've got dual passports. Again, ironic for Edu that his massive knowledge base is Brazilians with actual dual passports. And I think that's going to be one of the things he's asked to do at Arsenal, is to kind of convince, you know, work with people like Freddie Ljungberg and Per Mertesacker and identify a pathway into the first team for some of these young players. And that's very much what he's been doing for Brazil. So, you know, I know you wrote the other day about whether or not he was involved with Martinelli, maybe, maybe not. One decision I'm sure he would have been quite involved in is the decision to move Freddie Ljungberg into the first team coaching setup. And I think that's another thing to keep an eye on. If Arsenal are really serious about, you know, through financial necessity, absorbing some of this young talent into the first team, I think that will be a big part of Edu's role.
Yeah, potentially. I think that there's a bit more to come out in the wash about the Freddie Ljungberg, Steve Bould job swap thing, if you like, in that I think the two men who swapped jobs were the key drivers behind that happening, rather than the club itself making a decision, or certainly Edu making a decision. But that's sort of by the by. We can touch on what he's about to do and where he's about to go, but working with the Brazilian national team, you know, I think in general, from what I've read, he was pretty well regarded. There were a few moments which didn't go particularly well for him. How would you assess his work with them overall?
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, again, it's difficult to separate him from the coach, Chite, who obviously has to take most of the credit, but they were in complete disarray when he took this job. They'd been knocked out of the Copa America in the group stage. In 2016, they had an awful manager. Morale was really low. They had an awful coach, and things turned around instantly. Now, Edu, you know, you're probably asking yourself, like, but how much, like, who else is like a general coordinator for national teams? Like, it's just a job with very little profile. I'm not even sure I know who does that for England, if anyone.
Yeah.
But for Brazil, it was so high profile because Tite made sure that Edu was high profile. So when the squads were announced, it was Edu that did the squad announcing and things like that. And he spoke about the philosophy, and he talked about, you know, when there was a year to go till Copa America, he was the one who told the press, you know, look, for the first, you know, for the next few months, we're going to pick quite young squads. We're going to try some players out. And then as Copa America gets closer, we'll get more experienced and, you know, we'll start preparing for that. So Tite put him front and center in the spotlight. And that's why his job was so high profile. Mm. And I don't think he really, Edu had a real, you know, I think he made that job his own a little bit because the role became so much bigger when he came into it. Under Chite's insistence, you know, he was given free rein. But he was given quite a nice scenario where Brazil were at rock bottom and the CBF had to basically do everything Chite said.
Yeah.
So they were very weak, and Edu and Chite were very strong, and they were kind of saying, look, we'll do things this way, otherwise we're not taking the job. And so they had the power. But overall, I would say that he's certainly done a decent job. He goes out having won the Copa America on Brazilian soil, which, you know, in Brazil, the kind of it's looked upon slightly more harshly, but analysis in Brazil of the Brazilian national team begins and ends with the World Cup. It's a bit like Real Madrid in the Champions League.
Yeah.
It's just, if you don't win the World Cup, shut up and go away. We don't care about you. You know, we're not going to analyse why we didn't win the World Cup. Win it or shut up and go away. And if you don't win the World Cup, you're basically nothing. So, you know, I'm not going to pretend that like the Brazilian public were in love with the job he did simply because they didn't win the World Cup while he was doing it. So.
Yeah.
That's kind of the end of it. But I think looking at it from a more objective eye, I think he did a good job.
Okay. Well, you know, to have some strength of character as well to take on, not take on necessarily the Brazilian FA, but to be insistent about what you want, hopefully, you know, that will work in his favour with Arsenal. And he has arrived really, really quickly following the Copa America. I wasn't necessarily expecting him to come quite as soon as he did. Certainly some people had said to me that he might not be arriving until a little bit later in the summer. And even though there is still 4 weeks of the transfer window to go, I feel like his influence over what we do this summer is going to be limited. I know there's probably been some back channel communication, a bit of planning and what have you, but just in terms of him coming in and doing the job of technical director as specified in the, you know, what the club said the technical director was and the duties that he would perform, you know, he's going to need time in the job. He's got to get a proper assessment of all the staff that he's working with, the scouting staff, the football staff, the contract staff, playing staff, you know, the academy working with Per Mertesacker. All of that stuff is going to take time. So him coming in now, while I'm glad he's on board, it just feels a bit to me like they're getting as many hands on deck at what I guess could be perceived as a difficult time, given what we've done in the transfer market so far this summer is so limited.
Yeah, so I think there's a few interesting things about that. First of all, I'd say that his impact this summer will probably be negligible. And I reckon the club would, you know, obviously, like you say, they'll want as many hands on deck as possible. But really, the technical director, like Edu, won't be judged on this summer. The technical director is about what happens in 5, 10, 15 years' time. It's the real 1,000-foot view. Edu, I think, will begin to be able to judge him perhaps when Unai Emery goes and we see what the succession planning is, because the way I'm reading this is that what Edu is in charge of is, say, like the playing style, the philosophy. What type of players are we identifying? Where are they in their careers? What kind of contracts do they have? What's their pathway with us? Where can they get games and make their way into the team? And that will be with the academy as well as perhaps identifying young talent. So really his work, I think, will really start to take shape when we get a new manager, which I think might be next summer. If not, then not too long after that. So I don't think he'll be super hands-on in transfers, and whatever transfers we've got planned now, I'm sure they're all planned and that's it, and they're just trying to do them. I think Edu's role will be a much more 1,000-foot role, like what are we going to do when Emery's not here anymore and we've got another manager. And I think Edu's arrival in that respect perhaps puts some good pressure on Unai Emery, because there are two things perhaps we could have complained about last season. One was not kind of inculcating the young players well enough. The other one, the common criticism is, what is our style? What is our playing style?
Yeah.
That's part of Edu's brief. So I would imagine he's going to have to answer to Edu on that at this point.
I'm very curious about that. And we know that Edu is going to the US. He's going to be on the tour, which leaves or has left by the time this podcast goes out. We're recording a bit earlier, but the team traveling to the US on Thursday, Edu is with them. You mentioned to me that he's probably going to hook up with the Cronkies, which makes a lot of sense if Raul Sanyehi or whoever is going out there. They are going to be in Denver and LA, which is, Stan's stomping ground. So he could be involved in that. But I am really curious to see what kind of influence he is going to have over, essentially, without, being too obvious about it, the technical direction of the club. Because, he came from Brazilian football, which, as we all know, has its own sort of style and flair and panache. He came to Arsenal, went into probably the best Arsenal team that any of us have ever seen, won the double, went through the season unbeaten. We played amazing attacking football, but with an edge. There was a steel to this Arsenal, or to that Arsenal side, that certainly isn't present in the one that we have at the moment. There's a gap in quality, and there's a gap in character, and a gap in mentality. So I'm really curious as to see what kind of impact he will have. It's not something he can turn around in 3 months, or by standing up, in the dressing room and giving a speech. It's not that kind of a thing, but over time, your recruitment policy can really have a big impact on that. So you're looking for players who can do things on the pitch, but who also have the character and mentality to be able to cope with the challenges, which is where I think we currently fall down, that once we come out of our the nicely made bed, we find it very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing to say about his spell in Brazil as well, Chite has a very particular style of football. There's not a lot of panache about it, to be quite honest. It's quite functional, but hugely effective. If he could speak English, I do think Chite would make probably the perfect Chelsea manager. It's kind of that kind of football. It's not that easy on the eye, but super effective. He has a very particular style of football, and he instantly got Brazil playing that style of football. And he was calling up players who'd played for him at Corinthians, players who weren't the best players, like Paulinho, who's considered a bit of a joke in this country, and not just because he played for Spurs, but because he played badly for Spurs. But he's actually quite a decent player, but he fits Chite's style. And so even though he's not one of the best Brazilian players, they called him up because he knew how to play under Chite, and they called a few players up like that. And so again, he has had this experience of going from one place to another and kind of picking up a style with him. Now, again, obviously he doesn't have Chite with him this time to do that. So he's going to have to come up kind of with his own ideas. And the other challenge is, like we say, he's got a manager who perhaps doesn't really have a style or doesn't really want to settle on one. And I think Lewis Ambrose made a really good point on this podcast a few weeks ago about that can make recruitment quite tricky. If you're, you know, because Edu's going to go to Emery presumably and say, right, what kind of football are you going to play? And then we'll know what kind of player to try and get you. And
or you know, do you think it could be possible that Edu might say to Unai Emery, this is the kind of football we want you to play. These are the players that you've got to do it. It could cause friction, I guess.
It could. I think it could. I think it's likely that it will. To be honest, I think, you know, there have been a lot of misgivings over, you know, probably 10 years ago in England, even, you know, this kind of whole technical director, director of football, everyone kind of thought, really? Like, what's this about? And the reasons that people kind of doubted it are actually still quite valid, i.e., well, what if the manager doesn't agree? Like, those risks are still there. And so the risk is still there this time. Whether it's a risk or not, because you could argue, well, if Emery doesn't agree, then he's disposable anyway. And that's the kind of model we're moving towards here. It's we're setting the direction and you must fit into it. But I can imagine if I were a coach, I wouldn't like that. I wouldn't like to be told.
Yeah.
You're going to play this style. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. But I can understand why the club wants that.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if you go to Barcelona, you know you're going to have to play a certain kind of football. You're not going to be able to get away with playing like crappy defensive football at Barcelona because it's the ethos of the club. And I think that's something that was interesting when Sanjay was talking about what the role of technical director was. It's like, you know, making clear what the club's strategy is in the medium to long term. And it feels, you know, even under Arsene Wenger, in the last couple of years of Arsene Wenger, we sort of lost our way a bit in terms of the kind of football we all thought Arsenal would play, you know, because Wenger's style and his attacking philosophy is really easy to get behind when it works. You know, it's more difficult, of course, when things don't go that way. But, you know, even when we talk about the executive bumps in the road that we've had, like Sven comes in, Sven is gone. Ivan takes over, Ivan's gone. You know, we still haven't officially announced a head of recruitment, even though there's stuff going on behind the scenes. You know, it might take, and I think you wrote about this a couple of weeks ago on the blog, that it might take us a little bit of time to get the right combination. You know, think of it like one of those machines that you put 10p in, and if you get three hearts, you get, you know, money out. What do you call slot machines?
Slot machines, yeah.
So, you know, you can be pulling for ages, and you've got like a bell and a heart and a spade when you want three hearts. So it might take us a few pulls of the slot machine to get the right mix.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think it's a massive coincidence that, you know, guys like Edu and Freddie Ljungberg have come into it. I was slightly alarmed by the statement on the website where Raul Sanjay, he said, most importantly, Edu, you know, is an Arsenal man, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, that I hope that's just PR bluster, because that is not the most important thing. And, you know, frankly, Edu, he played for us for 4 years, like four very good years, but he's far more a Corinthians and Brazil man than he is an Arsenal man. The important thing is he's done this job before and he knows what he's doing. But kind of on that, I suppose as a kind of side point, isn't it weird how we all pine after these kind of former players to come into the setup? And, you know, if you're talking about the Invincibles, it's like, oh, Henri, Vieira, Bergkamp, a bit earlier, Tony Adams. Mm. Maybe people in the 80s were saying, oh, bring Frank McClintock in. But then it's guys like Liam Brady and then George Graham, who no one thought would be a manager, and Steve Bould and Freddie Ljungberg and Edu.
Yeah.
It's always like the people you least expect that actually end up doing it. But yeah. I do think that definitely part of the attraction is that Edu played in a team, not just that was successful, but like you say, had an identifiable style and had an idea. And, you know, Edu and Freddie Ljungberg as players were two guys who fitted into both sides of that Arsenal team in terms of they had the technical ability, but they had the steel and the kind of the mentality, and they bought into that side. And they were guys who were not from London, you know, who were imported from their home countries, but really got Arsenal quite quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of probably what Arsenal are really driving at here.
Yeah. I think that's true of Mertesacker as well, isn't it? Because he was somebody who instantly and immediately got what the club was about and how to connect with people and how to connect with fans.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely, and you know, and obviously Edu, most importantly, has a track record here. I would say, kind of as a side point as well, another part of the reason he might have come in so quickly. I don't think his family are going to come with him. Now, when he was doing the role for Brazil, he had to live in Rio, and his family lived in Sao Paulo. Now, obviously, Brazil's a massive country, but obviously Sao Paulo to London is slightly further, we're talking about. But they didn't go to Rio with him. His son is actually in the academy at Corinthians at the moment, so I don't think he'll want it to take him away from that. I think he's about 15 or 16. I think his daughter is as well, actually. I'm not sure if it's as serious as she's in the academy, but she plays. And she plays to a good level. So maybe Arsenal women will have their first Brazilian player out of this. But yeah, he might have also come over so quickly because, at least initially, his family might not come with him. Maybe they'll see how it goes for 6 months to a year. And if there's a reasonable expectation that he'll be here for the long haul, they might come over afterwards.
Right. Okay. Well, look, we'll wait and see. He's obviously got a big, big job on his hands. There's a lot of expectation that's coming with him as well, because we can all see that there are many things that need to be fixed and things that we would all like to see put right. How much of that is going to fall on him remains to be seen, but I think we all wish him the best of luck, because he's got a hell of a lot of work to get through. Tim, we better leave it there. Thanks a million, as always.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed to Tim. You know where to find him on Twitter. He is at Stilberto, and read his column, of course, every Thursday on arsblog.com. I should point out that we did have that conversation before all the Lauren Koscielny stuff went down. So Edu's job, which was already quite difficult, has become even more challenging. So I wish him even more luck than I wished him in the first place. Now, just a couple of bits and pieces, because I am going to be away from tomorrow. I'm going to be in the States covering the tour, covering the US preseason tour. I'll be at the games in LA, in Charlotte, and in Landover outside Washington, D.C., where we play Bayern Munich, Fiorentina, and Real Madrid, doing lots of stuff for Arsblog News, but also doing an exclusive tour diary for our Patreon members. So if you're a Patreon member, you'll get access to this extra bonus content. Andrew Allen and Tom are going to keep the blog ticking over while I'm away, so there'll always be a blog for you first thing in the morning, as always, with all the latest news and opinion and what have you. But if you want a bit more, if you want some behind the scenes stuff from the US tour, pictures, probably a couple of little small podcasts, maybe some video stuff and some articles, you can join at patreon.com/arsblog. It costs a fiver a month and you get instant access to everything that we have on there and all the other benefits that are coming. For example, later this summer, the Arsblog apps will be ad free if you log in with your Patreon details. So that's an extra bonus thank you for our Patreon members as well. To join, just go to patreon.com/arsblog. Also to mention that on Sunday, if you're in LA, we are doing a live Arscast from the underground in Hermosa Beach. ArsenalInLA.com have details on the tickets there. It's going to be myself, Elliot from the Arsenal Vision podcast. Also, James Benge from Football London will be there. We're going to have a panel discussion. We'll do Q&A. So if you fancy coming down to that, go to ArsenalInLA.com and you can pick up tickets there. Hopefully see lots of you there. I guess there's going to be a whole pile of stuff going on over the weekend in LA before the game. There are other events going on later in the tour, which I'll give you details of, but they're in Charlotte and also in Washington, D.C. I'll give you some details of those on the podcasts. The podcasts will continue as normal as much as possible. Time zones will mean that the publication of the podcast might be delayed here and there, but James and I will do an Arscast Extra on Monday. Depending on travel and depending on what's going on, there'll be a Friday Arscast. It might be a Thursday Arscast or a Saturday Arscast. But I'm going to try and keep the podcast going as much as possible, just to try and maintain some semblance of normality in what appears to be an increasingly crazy summer from an Arsenal point of view. As ever, thank you very much indeed for listening. Really do appreciate it. I will catch you on the next one, or catch you on Patreon. I'll catch you somewhere. Maybe catch you on Venice Beach in LA. Beefcake. Until then, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
So, as I was explaining to you, we have very good plan to bring in the players that we view as necessary to get this club back to where it needs to be, which is, of course, in the Champions League, because that's where all the big money is. And, of course, once you get in there, then you go to European Super League, and after that, there's squids in for everybody. Apart from fans, of course, but that's not the most important thing right now. One other strategy, key strategy that we have is... Excuse me, yes, come in. What? 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 Sorry, I have to cut the interview short here. All of our players are holding each other hostage, demanding outrageous things. But don't worry, it's all part of a very good plan. Very, very good plan. How the fuck are you gonna talk yourself out of this one, Raul?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.